Lake, Siege of Fort Niagara. The River Niagara was known to the Jesuits as early as 1640. The falls are indicated in Champlain's map of 1632, and in 1648 the Jesuit Rubigneau speaks of them as a cataract of frightful height. In 1678, the falls were visited by the friar Louis Hannepin, who gives an exaggerated description of them, and illustrates it by a curious picture. The name Niagara is of Iroquois origin, and in the Mohawk dialect is pronounced Niagara. In the year of Hannepin's visit, the followers of Cavalier de La Salle began a fortified storehouse where Lewiston now stands, and in Cayuga Creek, a few miles above the falls, La Salle built the Griffin, the first vessel that ever sailed in the Upper Lakes. At the same time he began a fort at the mouth of the river. La Salle's fort fell to ruin, and another was built in its place a few years after. This, too, was abandoned to be again rebuilt, and the post remained in French hands more than half a century. It was of the greatest importance, since it commanded the chief route from Canada to the interior of the continent. At length, in 1759, the year of Wolfe's famous victory at Quebec, General Prudhoe was sent to reduce it. Prudhoe safely reached Niagara, and laid siege to it. Fort Niagara was a strong work, lately rebuilt in regular form by an excellent officer, Captain Paget, of the Battalion of Bearden, who commanded it. It stood where the present fort stands, in the angle formed by the junction of the River Niagara with Lake Ontario, and was held by about 600 men, well supplied with provisions and munitions of war. Higher up the river, a mile and a half above the cataract, there was another fort, called Little Niagara, built of wood, and commanded by the half-breed officer, John Kerr Chabert, who is his brother, John Kerr Clausen, and a numerous clan of Indian relatives, had long thwarted the efforts of Sir William Johnson to engage the Five Nations in the English cause. But recent English successes had had their effect. John Kerr's influence was waning, and Johnson was now in Prudhoe's camp with 900 Five Nation warriors pledged to fight the French. John Kerr, finding his fort untenable, burned it, and came with his garrison and his Indian friends to reinforce Niagara. Paget had another resource, in which he confidently relied. In obedience to an order from Doddrill, the French population of the Illinois, Detroit, and other distant posts, joined with troops of Western Indians, had come down the lakes to restore French ascendancy in the Ohio. These mixed bands of white men and red, bushrangers and savages, were now gathered, partly at Lebeauf and Venango, but chiefly at Presqu'ile, under command of Aubry, Ligneris, Marin, and other partisan chiefs, the best in Canada. No sooner did Paget learn that the English were coming to attack him than he sent a messenger to summon them all to his aid. The siege was begun in form, though the English engineers were so incompetent that the trenches, as first laid out, were scoured by the fire of the place, and had to be made anew. At last the batteries opened fire. A shell from a coxhorn burst prematurely, just as it left the mouth of the piece, and a fragment striking Prudhoe on the head, killed him instantly. Johnson took command in his place, and made up in energy what he lacked in skill. In 2 or 3 weeks the fort was in extremity. The rampart was breached, more than 100 of the garrison were killed or disabled, and the rest were exhausted with want of sleep. Paget watched anxiously for the promised succors, and in the morning of the 24th of July distant firing told him that they were at hand. Aubry and Ligneris, with their motley following, had left Presqu'ile a few days before, to the number, According to Dahrwal, of 1,100 French and 200 Indians. Among them was a body of colony troops, but the Frenchmen of the party were chiefly traders and bushrangers from the west, connecting links between civilization and savagery. Some of them indeed were mere white Indians, imbued with the ideas and morals of the wigwam, wearing hunting shirts of smoked deerskin embroidered with quills of the Canada porcupine, painting their faces black and red, tying eagle feathers in their long hair, or plastering it on their temples with a compound of vermilion and blue. They were excellent woodsmen, skillful hunters, and perhaps the best bushfighters in all Canada. When Paget heard the firing, he went with a wounded artillery officer to the bastion next to the river, and as the forest had been cut away for a great distance, they could see more than a mile and a half along the shore. There, by glimpses among trees and bushes, they descried bodies of men, now advancing, and now retreating, Indians in rapid movement, and the smoke of guns, the sound of which reached their ears in heavy volleys, or a sharp and angry rattle. Meanwhile the English cannon had ceased their fire, and the silent trenches seemed deserted, as if their occupants were gone to meet the advancing foe. There was a call in the fort for volunteers to sally and destroy the works, but no sooner did they show themselves along the covered way than the seemingly abandoned trenches were thronged with men and bayonets, and the attempt was given up. The distant firing lasted half an hour, then ceased, and Paget remained in suspense, till, at 2 in the afternoon, a friendly Onondaga, who had passed unnoticed through the English lines, came to him with the announcement that the French and their allies had been routed and cut to pieces. Paget would not believe him. Nevertheless, his tale was true. Johnson, besides his Indians, had with him about 2,300 men, whom he was forced to divide into three separate bodies, one to guard the bateaux, one to guard the trenches, and one to fight Aubry and his band. This last body consisted of the provincial light infantry and the pickets, two companies of grenadiers, and 150 men of the 46th Regiment, all under command of Colonel Massey. They took post behind an abattis at a place called La Belle Famille, and the Five Nation warriors placed themselves on their flanks. These savages had shown signs of disaffection, and when the enemy approached, they opened a parley with the French Indians, which, however, soon ended, and both sides raised the war whoop. The fight was brisk for a while, but at last Aubry's men broke away in a panic. The French officers seemed to have made desperate efforts to retrieve the day, for nearly all of them were killed or captured, while their followers, after heavy loss, fled to their canoes and boats above the cataract, hastened back to Lake Erie, burned Presqu'île, Lebeuf, and Venango, and, joined by the garrisons of those forts, retreated to Detroit, leaving the whole region of the Upper Ohio in undisputed possession of the English. At 4 o'clock in the day of the battle, after a furious cannonade in both sides, a trumpet sounded from the trenches, and an officer approached the fort with a summons to surrender. He brought also a paper containing the names of the captive French officers, though some of them were spelt in a way that defied recognition. Paget, feigning incredulity, sent an officer of his own to the English camp, who soon saw an answerable proof of the disaster, for here, under a shelter of leaves and boughs near the tent of Johnson, sat Ligneris, severely wounded, with Aubry, Milliers, Montigny, Marin, and their companions in misfortune, in all, 16 officers, 4 cadets, and a surgeon. Paget had now no choice but surrender. By the terms of the capitulation, the garrison were to be sent prisoners to New York, The honors of war were granted them in acknowledgement of their courageous conduct. There was a special stipulation that they should be protected from the Indians, of whom they stood in the greatest terror, lest the massacre of Fort William Henry should be avenged upon them. Johnson restrained his dangerous allies, and, though the fort was pillaged, no blood was shed. The capture of Niagara was an important stroke. Thenceforth Detroit, Michilimackinac, the Illinois, and all the other French interior posts were severed from Canada and left in helpless isolation. The conquest of the whole interior became only a question of time.